Trigger warning. This podcast addresses deeply rooted and challenging topics. It is written for open-minded individuals who are seeking insight and alternative perspectives on the complex histories of cults and their leaders. Many cults are destructive, and some of the content presented here may be emotionally triggering. This podcast is not recommended for young people, as some content may be inappropriate. Listener discretion advised. Welcome to Cult Following.
Today we're examining a new religious movement founded by charismatic leaders in the mid-1960s. This controversial religion developed a theology melding esoteric biblical motifs with psychoanalysis. It may have influenced the likes of Charles Manson and the Son of Sam, David Berkowitz himself. This is the Process Church of the Final Judgment on today's Cult Following. Hi, Dr. Katie.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
Well, here we are. We're back again.
We are. I'm very happy to be back, as always.
We're down one host today. Lisa is exploring Germany as we speak, so hopefully she's having a fun trip.
Yeah, I'll be really excited to hear about that trip and how that goes. I've never been to Germany, so.
She's always traveling somewhere around the world to some weird exotic location, and this, although this isn't so much a weird exotic location, she's going to this little German town that's like a giant Christmas bazaar every year. It's like one of the coolest, apparently one of the coolest places to go shopping for Christmas stuff in the world.
Oh, that's neat. I've never heard of that.
Is St. Nicholas a German saint? I can't remember, but I know Germany has a deep connection to, like, you know, Santa Claus and Christmas and all that. I'm not really sure, but.
Yes, that's true. I always think of Krampus. I think of Germany, that might be Austria. Maybe somebody knows the answer to that.
The lines are all blurred right there on those borders. I should know more about Germany. It's my heritage. But it's interesting that she's in Germany, though, because I was thinking about this before we started recording today, about Germany's really strict cult laws. It's actually, Europe in general has a lot of rules regarding cults, but Germany actually has more than anyone, probably for good reason. But I was doing a little research before we got on today, and these questionable groups, this is how they describe it: entities espousing a worldview and new religions. These types of groups can be illegal, and they can arrest you, put you in prison for doing this. So I was looking, there was actually a really long list that was posted on a German government website of kind of new religious movements and companies and things like that, universities that are illegal to function in Germany. So Fiat Lux is on the list, which some people may know as an MLM group, which is luxury jewelry. So it's an MLM, totally against the law in Germany. Universal Life, which is the Universal Life Church, which most people get ordained as a minister in to marry people. The Unification Church, which is the Moonies. any group with a pagan background. Osho is banned. This one, next one, is really weird. Transcendental meditation is illegal in Germany. What do you think about that?
That's interesting. I'm wondering if they have really gone to the other extreme with those TM laws.
Yeah, TM is apparently considered a cult in Germany. Landmark education, which, you know, a lot of people know about taking Landmark classes. There's Landmark facilities all over the country. Landmark is illegal. Scientology, which Scientology is in a huge legal battle with the German government to not have that be. They're probably one of the most outspoken of that rule, that law. Anything that deals with occultism or Satanism, and of course, multi-level marketers. So I just thought that was an interesting little side note, thinking about Lisa in Germany, and she doesn't have to worry about any cults while she's there. But
That's true. I mean, I've, I can understand the basis for putting those laws in place, at least on some level. But, you know, I also think that it's, I don't know, that might be a little strict.
It's interesting because I think Americans get spoiled with our Bill of Rights, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of, like, you know, all this stuff we can have. You can't do this in other countries. You say the wrong word in Paris and you're in jail, you know, and United Kingdom, people don't own guns there for very specific reasons. And I think Americans just really take advantage of things. You remember that kid, this has been a long, long time ago. You remember that American kid who was caned in Thailand for graffitiing something and how big of like a national story that was? Like, Americans take liberties with their liberty and they push it on people in other countries. And I think probably Germany, particularly probably, you know, the fascists that were there, the Nazi party, they probably have a good reason to be critical of anything new that might become, you know, bad. I know a lot of some of the things I didn't mention that are outlawed there, like a lot of right-leaning organizations are outlawed. So yeah, they definitely keep a vigilant eye to make sure nothing new springs up and grows there.
Yeah, I think, I mean, based on, you know, your history, where you're coming from, it could make sense that you would go in that extreme of a direction with it.
You've heard me talk before, you know, in our podcast and just, you know, at different times about my issues with the state of Kentucky. And some of the problems in Kentucky is generational thinking, I believe. You know, you get a couple of counties in and people are racist and bigoted, and it's because their dads were and their grandpas were, and that's all they've ever known. They don't know anything beyond that, what they've always learned from their parents. And I don't know if psychologically there's something to this or not, but if you think about it, in Germany, we're barely three generations removed from World War II. It's not even been 100 years. So I guess for them, it really probably is still, you may still have the thinking of a parent or a grandparent, which could put you in that line of thinking that, you know, you might still have a living relative that thought like the Nazis did, you know? And do you think there's anything to that, that kind of that generational way of thinking?
I mean, I do think that there's generational family dynamics and thinking and, you know, religion. I think all of that plays a part in the way that families continue to work together. I think,
you know, there is a thought construct there of some sort. I think, you know, people grow up maybe politically or what religion they are, you know, all as a result of maybe what their family, what your mom and dad were Democrats. Well, that may be the first thing you know growing up. But it is fascinating. I think one of the things, you know, I mentioned that occultism and Satanism is something that Germany has outlawed. And that's really kind of a little bit about that kind of leads into the process church we're going to talk about here today. And let's jump into it, because this is an interesting one. This kind of has a little bit of a callback to one of our first episodes with the Manson family, which will be interesting to bring up here in a bit. But I'm going to jump into the origin of the process church, and then we can take this apart and let the listeners decide whether this is a cult or not. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, here's a little bit of the origin. The Process Church of the Final Judgment is commonly known as the Process Church, and it was a religious group established in the UK in 1963. Its founders were the British couple Marianne MacLean and Robert de Grimston, and this church spread across parts of the UK and the United States during the latter 1960s and 70s. They developed a distinctive theology based on four gods: Jehovah, Lucifer, Satan, and Christ, and they were collectively referred to as the great gods of the universe. Now, accordingly, these deities were not worshipped by the churchgoers. The church stated that Jehovah is strength, Lucifer is light, Satan is separation, Christ is unification, and each member was instructed to follow the god or gods which were best suited to them. Each individual was understood as a combination of two of these gods. The church taught that an individual's personality and relationships could be explained by reference to which gods he manifested at any given time. None of these deities were considered evil, which I think is interesting, but they're basic patterns of human reality. And the church taught that the real devil was humanity or the gray forces, which were understood as representing the compromise and conformity typical of the masses, people being plugged in the matrix. Some scholars of religion have classified this new religious movement as a form of Satanism. So kind of jumping in there, Katie, what do you think right out of the gate, kind of hearing about their ideology?
This one is really interesting to me because it's different than a lot of the other cults that we've discussed so far. I mean, this idea of these, you know, four separate entities that you're worshiping that kind of represent the basic patterns of human reality or humanity. That's interesting to me. That's kind of, it kind of leans a little bit psychoanalytic in some way. And so that is an interesting take to me, especially since we normally see these cults as something that, you know, groups that are generally following one specific god or ideology. And so this, and usually there's kind of a good and a bad, right? And this is a little more broken up, and including Lucifer and Satan, and they aren't necessarily being cast as the bad, right? Against the right. Good that would be God or whatever the holy entity normally is. So I find that piece really interesting.
You know, one of the controlling aspects of cults is, you know, pitting you against something. You know, they'll pit you against your family, separate you from them. And this cult seems to be pitting their group against the masses. Like, hey, we're doing it right. And everyone out there, you know, they're against us or we're against them. And you see that as kind of one, I think, one of the controlling factors that you typically see with these cults. And I think also by saying that you can, you know, you pick two and this is what you are, is a great way to disguise your bad behavior. Well, that was Satan in me doing that. You know, you got to get away with a little more. It might be a way to, you know, condone your behavior within the group, you know, especially if the group is having you do weird stuff, which we're going to get into in a bit. You have a little bit of information about the leaders of this cult. You want to give that to us?
That's very true. Yes, I do. One last thought too, before we move on to that piece. I think the other thing that's interesting is just the, like you're saying, this is a good way to kind of separate not only the bad things that you do, right? Or the things that are seen as bad or looked down upon by the other members of this group, but a good way for you to be separated from humanity as a whole, right? Or from the rest of society. This is kind of an easy in for this kind of a group to make you feel special or different, and seeing everybody else as followers of you know, something else blindly, and mm-hmm. you are the one that is enlightened here. So I find that to be a little bit of a manipulation tactic, possibly mm-hmm. Something that we often see as well, but a little bit different in this respect. So yeah, so just to give a little bit more background here, McLean and de Grimston met while both were members of the Church of Scientology in the early 1960s. The duo were ejected from the church in 1962 and married the following year. They started a Scientology splinter group called Compulsions Analysis, which incorporated new religious elements and developed into the Process Church, which was established in London in 1966. Its members initially lived in a commune in Wayfair, West London, before moving to Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. They later established a base of operations in the United States and New Orleans. The Process was a creative organization characterized by ritual innovation, non-conventional sexual and living arrangements, and a publication strategy that produced distinctive arresting magazines. So something a little bit different here as well. Its members were known as processions, and they wore dramatic costumes that were highly visible on the streets of American cities in the late 1960s and early 1970s. So that's a pretty good visual image there for you.
Hippies.
Yeah.
they're always hippie cults, aren't they?
I think I'm just imagining like a combination of the hippie culture and then, you know, they mentioned New Orleans. And so now I've got this whole idea
you got Mardi Gras
of Mardi Gras and that whole cultural aspect as well. So,
so many started in the 60s and 70s, you know, it's crazy.
They really did.
I know you have more stuff that you want to read about, but I'll just interject really quick. You know, there's kind of an old saying that like kids rebel against their parents. They don't want to do what their parents did. You know, if your dad was a letter carrier, the last thing you want to do is be a public servant of some sort. You're going to do something else. And if your parent was, you know, an actor, the kids of actors aren't going to necessarily want to grow up to be like that or have that lifestyle, you know? So you see like rock stars and celebrities of all types with kids that are going a completely different direction than what their parents did for whatever reason. So I don't know, you know, in the world of psychology or sociology or whatever it might be, why that is that kids don't want to do what their parents did. But I think when you look at the baby boomer generation and you kind of see how those kids grew up and even the kids of those kids that would have been around in the 60s and 70s, why there would be a good need to rebel and what would be more of a rebellion from what the parents of the 30s and 40s and 50s were like than to, you know, have the free love movement of the 60s and have much different kinds of religious freedoms. And you start to see things like Buddhism and Hinduism coming into America and, you know, a lot of different exposures. So we see so many cults coming out of the 60s and 70s for these kids that are searching for something that's entirely different. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but clearly in the case of cults, it's a bad thing.
I think that's a really interesting point. It makes me think, like you're saying, they were moving away from that idea of conservatism that was in place in the 50s, right, and before that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of see a shift away from that societally, or at least culturally or subculturally. And, you know, that's interesting when we take that and put it in the context of a cult, because maybe that's where some of these people were moving, right? They were trying to move away from this conservatism, but they're still finding themselves in these really highly structured, oftentimes religious groups, right? Even though they might see these ideas as being something novel and different than what they've seen before, inherently it's kind of a similar idea underneath all of that. So I find that to be pretty fascinating.
That is interesting. I'd never really thought of it like that. It's really, they've kind of come full circle in a way. It's parallel maybe to what they had before.
Yeah.
No, not exactly the same, but kind of running the same, trajectory as what they were in before. It's interesting.
Potentially not that far away from what they wanted to escape.
You know, generations used to be defined by 30 years. A generation was every 30 years. And then when we got close to the turn of the century, that narrowed. And now generations are, you know, 15 to 30 years. But generations are spinning quicker and quicker and quicker. And it's hard to almost keep track of where we're at with nostalgia or kind of throwbacks to other things. So you think, well, if you look at, you know, a generation going by and you take 30 years past the 60s, and you had a grunge movement, which really mirrored or was parallel to what you saw with the 60s. Really a very distinctively different type of raw sound that was uniquely different than anything you had in the 70s and the 80s. And you kind of maybe want to skip ahead 20 more or 30 more years and then look at where we're at today with the kids that have grown up with a culture of the internet and also getting COVID and the whole problem, all this post-COVID problem of, you know, no jobs or maybe people just not wanting to work jobs or being kind of maybe psychologically damaged from not being able to spend time with their friends their senior year or do the things that are typical of what a senior in high school would do. No proms, no graduations. You strip all that stuff from people. You isolate people. You take away their income. You take away their job. And we might be moving into another period of some weird counterculture that's happening. I think it's yet to be determined. Do you think there's any weight to that?
I think it's very possible. There are definitely things that have happened, like you, all of the things you just mentioned that could definitely lead to something like that happening again. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, that's a very different way to experience a young life and to grow up than anything that we've really seen or encountered before. And so that's going to come with some new ideas and subcultures and a different cultural movement.
Lockdown, you know, I owe the success of my first book to lockdown, because when people couldn't go anywhere or do anything, I mean, the world could have ended. No one knew what was going to happen with this contagion that was out there, and spiritual books flew off the shelves. Like, it was crazy how many people were downloading them and reading. Like, it was crazy what people needing to connect with something, you know, to figure out what it all meant. And of course, you get the spiritual people that are, this is the incoming, you know. So a very odd time to, very weird, crazy thing for us to live through, you know.
Yes, but, I agree. It feels surreal now that it even happened that way or during our lifetime. So, yeah, I'll be interested to see the long-term impact of that.
There will be studies. You'll have them before anyone.
Yes. Yes. And I think that it will shape how people have grown up and how we all move forward. And yeah, I think when you're isolated like that, it you tend to be forced to be a little more introspective and touch on those spiritual pieces. So I'm not surprised by that.
Speaking of isolation, you have a little information on their communal life. Do you want to tell the listeners about that?
I do. So the communal life of the church members was very strictly regulated. Among group members, sex and the use of drugs and alcohol were strictly rationed. These practices were regarded as a distraction from spiritual work. Men and women lived separately and were expected to be celibate. Since most were in their early 20s, that didn't really work out very well. There were children born, and when they were, the parents were not allowed to raise them. So families in this group were seen as obsolete. Sect leaders believed breaking families up was the ethical thing to do.
And it's a throwback to what we just talked about the rebellion of kids in the 60s. What did those 60s kids grow up with? Family life. And here they're saying families were obsolete. So very, very interesting. Almost proves our point a little bit in terms of how people want to rebel against how their parents live.
Yeah, the celibacy piece is a little bit different than what we normally talk about as well.
With the free love of a lot of these cults.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they even if they're communal, it seems like celibacy just isn't a part of it usually.
I don't think we have the information here, but I did read in some other places about how they regulated drug use and how they were really against people being on any kind of illegal drugs or alcohol. They were okay with nicotine and caffeine, but they really discouraged anything else because they wanted people to keep their eye on the spiritual practice here, which also was very different from, you know, kind of the counterculture of the 60s. Although I should say, you know, Americans got the hippies. Nowhere else in the world did. You know, people don't like Europeans and Asians are really fascinated by what went on in America. They like cowboys. They like hippies. They like bikers because they didn't get that stuff over there. People don't realize that. Even disco music, although kind of based in Latin music, the disco was still something uniquely American, and Europe and Asia love that part of our culture. So there was a 60s scene in the United Kingdom, but it wasn't really the hippie scene. And because these people developed this the way they did, they might have just not wanted to subscribe to what the Americans were doing necessarily, or maybe didn't know about it. So, you know, had this sprung up in San Francisco, it might have been a completely different story than it actually, you know, being built in London or wherever it came up at.
I wonder, this also makes me think about, you know, could this have been a draw for people who were looking to try to get away from their own drug or alcohol use or abuse? Yeah. I was just looking up when AA Alcoholics Anonymous was originated, and it says it was originated in 1935.
Wow.
It was a bit before this, but I'm kind of seeing similarities as far as maybe a place where you could go with a group of people and there's somebody there that's trying to help regulate that use. And if this could be a place where you might feel safe to try to move away from that and more into a spiritual light.
Yeah. We obviously, this is an audio only podcast, so people don't really get a chance to see the imagery, but you know, what you have, with De Grimston is you had the typical, you know, creepy bearded looking Jesus Savior figure that would run a cult. And the symbol that they chose is very swastika influenced. Not quite a swastika, but at a first glance, you would see that. And of course, you saw black and white propaganda. You saw their swastika-like symbol on all of their propaganda. And I don't know if I agree with you, Dr. Katie, that people would go there to get help with liquor after seeing the imagery and then also coming in. And I mean, what person doesn't know about Satan? So once you mention a Satan is one of the people you worship, how does that not scare people off? Yet this group got hundreds and hundreds of followers.
That's true. I just think sometimes when people are looking for an out or looking for some kind of an answer,
they'll go anywhere.
Maybe they'll go in directions that they would not normally go.
For sure. Well, what else you got about, what else did you research and find out?
So unlike other satanic groups active during this same time period, the Process Church did not practice magic. The church held public rituals similar to Christian practices, such as baptisms, marriages, and a weekly gathering titled the Sabbath Assembly. Baptisms were performed at every elevation of status in the hierarchy of the church. The processions sang solemn hymns to the four deities during the assemblies. And in 1974, McLean and De Grimston separated. The latter tried to continue the group with a small following, but this ended up folding in 1979. McLean retained the allegiance of the majority of church members, reforming the group as the Foundation Church of the Millennium and taking it into an explicitly Christian direction. The organization was eventually reorganized several different times.
Which will probably come as a surprise to our listeners when we get to the end here. We're not going to spoil it yet, though. I have a couple other things to mention about this. You know, obviously, this seems like a pattern with almost every episode, but this has the typical hallmarks of a hippie counterculture cult. A distinctive theology, Scientology influence, distribution of propaganda, communal living, non-conventional sexual arrangements. We see this over and over and over again, don't we?
We do. So there are some things that are pretty strikingly different, and that will become more apparent as we move through the episode here, like you just mentioned. But I think, yeah, all of those basic hallmarks are there. I do think it's, I don't know, the description of it as a satanic type cult, I think for me, just based on the way that it's structured and the way that they are practicing, to me, it doesn't come off that way. It still seems a little bit more kind of Christian based in Christianity or a sect of that. And they've just kind of separated.
It had me at Satanic Church when it mentioned Lucifer and Satan.
Well, I think on the surface, right, we're not used to seeing those figures be a part of the bigger pieces of worship, right? And sure. Like we mentioned earlier, this cult seems to have not separated things into, you know, this is definitely good, this is definitely bad. Instead, it's all of these things are kind of inside of us. You pick two. And so I guess, you know, technically they're worshiping Satan. I think just at the foundational level, it still seems very Christian, evangelical based to me. So
that's fascinating.
It's an interesting blend, I think.
I have a couple of additional facts. Marianne McLean had spent a year in the United States and had a relationship with the boxer Sugar Ray Robinson, and worked as a high-end prostitute in London, servicing prominent figures in British business and politics. Very interesting start for a cult leader. McLean joined Scientology and began working as an auditor at the London branch of the Church of Scientology. And for those that don't know, auditing in Scientology is one of the most common practices there. And it's an activity where a trained Scientologist is known as an auditor, and they listen to and ask a subject various questions. And through auditing, the subjects are said to free themselves from barriers that inhibit their natural abilities. And it's also kind of the stepping stones for going up in the organization at Scientology. So you're audited constantly. And, you know, some people will call that a brainwashing technique. Some people just, you know, they call it therapy. Sometimes that's what it is, a therapy session. And sometimes it's more like a quiz to see what you know about Scientology. I can't, you know, I'm not horribly against Scientology, and I've read Dianetics and I know a lot of Scientologists. And I think it's fascinating how their organization works. But we have someone that's skilled enough in Scientology to become an auditor, because you do need to be very skilled in it. So she certainly had a little bit of that foundation rooted in her when she decided to start her own thing. Another interesting fact was it was in Mexico that the group clarified its hierarchical structure with the De Grimstons at the top, and they started referring to themselves as the Omega, and others below them were regarded as masters, and then there were priests, and then there were prophets, and then finally there were messengers. What do you think about that? I always bring this up because I think it's always fascinating. Like Keith Raniere is the vanguard, you know? I'm going to start calling myself Imperious Leader in this podcast. Right. Katie, refer to me as the Imperious Leader.
But they do always seem to move into, you know, different, this hierarchical structure and different special names.
Do you think that they sit around and they go, hey, what should we call ourselves? Let's call ourselves the Omega. And someone's like, no, the De Grimstons called themselves that. And this, okay, well, what if I call myself Vanguard? No, you can't call yourself that because Keith Raniere called himself that. And like, do you think that goes on? And they're like, we can't use that guy's name because, you know, it's like a round table meeting.
Maybe, right? I'm like, why wouldn't they use Alpha? It's the first option. There's an A. Alpha One, then everybody can find you in the phone book. Some people probably right. Don't know what that is anymore.
There was an Alpha in The Walking Dead, so they did cover it on that show. But I always, you know, I know it's nothing really. I guess I try to make more of it than it really is, whether this is incredibly narcissistic to call yourself, you know, by this nickname. Like, why can't they just be their names? Why can't it just be, you know, Marianne and so-and-so running the show here? Why isn't that good enough? Like, I mean, even the podcast I do for Father Dan, the Karate Priest, sure, the Karate Priest is his nickname, but we still call him Father Dan, you know, like, right. Why is it not good enough?
He's not forcing you to call him the karate priest.
Only the Pope gets the special name, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's like, it's a collective this time as well. So it's this, you know, a couple of different people who are at the top that are called the Omega as a collective. So it's just, I mean, I guess in any kind of structured hierarchical system, there are going to be different names just to differentiate people, but it does seem like something that
is it ceremonial? Creative, I think it's a ceremonial name.
Possibly. That's a good thought. I mean, that would make a little bit more sense. I think it's the most interesting piece is that it's always something very grand, right? Very grandiose sounding, the Omega. That's a common one in the cults that we have covered so far.
We even had a Pope we talked about in a recent episode. Remember, we had an episode where the guy called himself a Pope. Yeah. By November of 1966, most of the Process members were back in London. Between the end of that year and 1967, the Process began to operate as a church. It became increasingly evangelistic and focused on attracting new members. It opened a library and an all-night coffee shop known as Satan's Cavern. It also began issuing a magazine, at first titled The Common Market and later renamed The Process. The church's activities attracted the interest of a number of celebrities active in the realms of music and cinema, among them Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull. So, what is it about these crazy cult groups that celebrities just want to rush to join them?
That was my exact thought. I was also wondering, what is it? Is there some mutually beneficial arrangement? Do the celebrities actually buy into this ideology, or are they just kind of drawn in by the idea of power or this, you know, this pedestal of godliness that's offered? Do they expect that they will be in the upper echelons with, you know, with the Omega or whoever the the leader would be, or are they really drawn in as a member on the ground floor, like some of the other people would be? You know, I'm always curious about that.
Well, it's fascinating because obviously, I mean, I think everybody knows about the famous Scientologists, the Tom Cruises and the John Travoltas of the world. And of course, you've had Mormon families like the Osmonds that have been very, you know, pro-Mormon and what they've done. You know, the Jackson family, Michael Jackson, Jehovah's Witnesses, very open about that. NXIVM, of course, had a ton of, you know, mid-level celebrities that were there. So there is certainly an attraction to these things, you know, and not that I'm necessarily lumping the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses in as cults, but, you know, a lot of very, you know, interesting types of religions, new religious movements, spiritualities, what have you. These people are attracted to it.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's some draw there. There's some connection. And maybe it's, you know, maybe it just so happens that they're celebrities and they have a personality that kind of aligns with being interested in joining something that could be considered a cult.
Sure.
You know, or maybe they are offering something else like money or, you know, some other connection. I think it's hard to say. And maybe it's a little bit of both.
It could also be urban legend or something, too. You know, Mick Jagger could have just happened onto one of those churches after playing out one night, you know, and just walked in the wrong bar, you know, or decided, oh, Satan's Coffee House looks pretty good to go to. I'll pop in here. Right. And then it's just lore, right? That like, oh, well, it attracted him. Well, he attracted him for a cup of coffee. And maybe it never went any further than that, you know?
You know, as a millennial myself, I have to say Satan's Coffee House sounds like a new
Satan's
age
Cavern,
hipster.
Yeah. Satan's Cavern, yeah,
Satan's
which is a coffee
Cavern.
House. Yeah.
It sounds like a new age millennial gentrification of coffee to me. I have to just point that out.
Oh, that's funny.
I think that could potentially draw some people in still now.
Probably
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. from late 1968 onward, they began spending most of their time in the United States. The church opened chapters in many U.S. cities, the first of which was in New Orleans. Several European chapters followed in Munich, Rome, and London. In the early 1970s, it opened its largest chapter in Toronto, Canada, and it's believed there were only a few hundred members in each chapter. Speaking of celebrities or the infamous that were part of this, why don't you tell everyone about the Charles Manson connection? Because we did a very compelling, very popular two-part episode on the Manson family, and we dug into Charles deeply. One of our first episodes we did. So it's kind of interesting callback here about how Manson came to be associated with this.
It is. So, unexpectedly, at least for me, first diving into this particular cult, was that Charles Manson popped up as someone that was connected, possibly. So prosecutors investigating the Los Angeles murders committed by the Manson family in 1969 suggested that there were links between Charles Manson and the Process Church. Although no proof of such a connection was ever provided, Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor of the Manson trial, later suggested in his book Helter Skelter that Manson may have borrowed philosophically from the Process Church. Although no connection between the Process Church and Manson was ever substantiated, the group's reputation was damaged by that association, and they began softening their image and limiting their satanic elements at that point.
And for those listeners, if you want to go back and listen to the old episode we did on the Manson family, we do discuss in that when he went to San Francisco, remember he left from Kentucky to go to San Francisco. And when he got to San Francisco, the two things that he got into was the Satanic Church, which at the time we didn't have any data on what that Satanic Church was, and Scientology. He dabbled in both. And those were the things that influenced him before he ever went to LA. And the Manson family didn't actually get assembled until he got to LA. And he took that data with him. And what do we have here? A Scientology connection and a Satanic Church connection. And this could have likely been the Satanic Church connection that he was part of. So I have a little bit more to add to this. In his 1972 book, The Family, Ed Sanders alleged that Manson had been a member of the Process Church, with evidence citing the fact that Manson once lived on the same road as the church's San Francisco location. That year, the church took legal action against Sanders and his U.S. publisher, E.P. Dutton, in the District Court of Chicago, and the allegation was retracted from future printings of the book. What do you think about that? Is it possible? I mean, come on. You're living on a street in San Francisco, walking up and down that street, you see the Satanic Church, you're not going to pop in if you're Charles Manson? Come on.
I guess the question is how many Satanic churches were available to visit?
I know.
Maybe he did find another one. I do think it's interesting that it was retracted from future printings, mm-hmm. and that it was never actually substantiated. I mean, I could see that either being true or not.
I have trouble, you know, there was more faith in journalism. Not that a book is necessarily journalism, but there was a little bit more faith in journalism in the 70s. Now, no one believes anything they see. Everyone thinks it's clickbait or AI is writing something. No one believes what reporters write anymore. But the author of this book, it wouldn't have been difficult to figure out where Charles Manson lived and where the location of a business was. I just can't see how this is a fabricated thing, you know, because those are easy records to find. It's, you know, there is a record of where the Process Church was at in San Francisco. So did Manson live on that same street or not? Because there's probably some evidence to support that, and probably people still alive that could support that. You know, it's very likely he could have, and why single that church out, you know, if it wasn't true?
That's true, especially just because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a Scientology scale of church or movement.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, that's a very good point.
Another interesting connection is the son of Sam, David Berkowitz, and his connection to the Process Church. It's long been argued that David Berkowitz didn't act alone in his kind of his crime spree, and that there were two possible church members that were his accomplices, but those two members were never brought to justice and never really named. And of course, you know, David Berkowitz, you know, thought the devil was talking to him, that the devil was in a dog. Like, you know, I mean, this guy was out there and definitely had his satanic connections. So very interesting thing there. But this, like all cults, it fell apart, and you've got the breakdown on how that happened. Do you want to tell everyone about that?
I do. So the relationship between the de Grimstons grew strained. Robert had begun a relationship with a younger woman who later became his third wife, and they also disagreed on the general direction of the Process Church. So McLean believed that they should declare the satanic phase to be over and be replaced by a Christian phase, and Robert disagreed. So in 1974, the de Grimstons separated officially. Robert took a minority of the group members with him, seeking to continue the Process Church in a manner similar to its original form, and then subsequently abandoned that project in 1979 when he moved professionally into business. So most of the church's members retained their allegiance to McLean. She renamed the church as the Foundation Church of the Millennium, which in 1977 became the Foundation Faith of the Millennium, and then in 1980, the Foundation Faith of God. Followers generally refer to it just simply as the Foundation. The group defined itself as a Christian church, which required its members to believe in the Trinity, the divinity of Jesus Christ, and his second coming. It also promoted a healing ministry, which was influenced by Pentecostalism. And like the Process Church, membership was organized according to that hierarchical system of degrees and led by a 9-member council of luminaries.
That's what we're going to call ourselves from this point on, the three of us, luminaries. We're luminaries. We're taught as the imperious leader.
we'll let you believe that you're the imperious leader, Todd.
The Imperious Leader, for those that aren't sci-fi nerds like me, was the Imperious Leader was in Battlestar Galactica. It was like the leader of the Cylons was the Imperious Leader.
Okay.
Anyways, I have a little bit more to add. McLean's principal collaborator in the group was longstanding church member Timothy Wiley. In 1977, he founded a group in New York City called The Unit, which he regarded as being part of the Foundation. McLean disagreed with this move and sued Wiley. Although she lost, the unit did disband, and Wiley then pursued an independent career in New Age spirituality with a focus on communicating with extraterrestrials, angels, and dolphins. So, Dr. Katie, what do you say to the patient that comes in your office and says, I've been communicating with extraterrestrials, angels, and dolphins? Are they immediately committed, or do you actually have some conversations with them?
I usually try to have several conversations with them and, you know, narrow down more specifics. But I would say that definitely perks my ears up if someone were to come in and say that they were communicating with extraterrestrials, angels, and dolphins.
But that's not even the weird part. It's about to get weirder.
It is about to get weirder. And there's still kind of a bleed through into this next piece here with Wiley moving in that direction. It's very, very left turn here. So
the rest of the group's going to start communicating with dogs.
Right.
In more ways than one.
Things get really weird moving forward now. So in 1982, the Foundation Faith of God moved its base to Utah, where it ended up establishing an animal rescue refuge. So in 1993, the organization changed its name to Best Friends Animal Society and removed all reference to religious ideas from its statutes. In 2004, a feature article in the Rocky Mountain News publicly revealed Best Friends' origins in the Process Church. In 2005, McLean died, and the management of her charity was left to her second husband, Gabriel DePire, a former Foundation Faith of God church member. So the group now cares for about 1,600 animals and facilitated nearly 27,000 pet adoptions around the country in 2019. The headquarters draws thousands of volunteers and visitors each year, and in 2019, the nonprofit received $101 million in donations. It's perhaps best known for taking in 22 of former NFL star Michael Vick's fighting dogs and for being featured in the National Geographic show Dogtown. So in 1989 and 1990, several former members of the church attempted to recreate it in Round Lake, New York. There were also reports of a revival group being based in Yorkshire, England.
I'm jumping up and down here wanting to just comment on every word you said there. You start as a satanic church and turn into a $101 million animal rescue.
And that begs the question, what was the ultimate goal here?
Wow. Right? And what is with these church attempts to recreate it in upstate New York? Like, why do all the cults want to be like, oh, upstate New York seems like a great idea, you know?
That is true. That has popped up in several of the cults that we've covered. What a ride. It was just certainly a journey from the beginning of this cult to where we ended up.
When you read this, when I sent you the notes for this, did you expect where this was going to go?
I definitely did not. I did not see it going in this direction. I guess one of the things is that I thought was, well, this is kind of a nice, happier ending, as far as we know, on the surface, at least. It's a much happier ending than a lot of the other cults that we talk about.
Right.
At least the information we have. And ideally, they're actually helping animals and doing something good in the world.
For a little while, their website did have in the About section a little bit about the origins of this of their operation, and then that's now been removed. So now it's just when you, and the website is really impressive. I mean, this group really does rescue a lot of animals, and they set up these animals for adoption all over the country. So really fascinating. But you know, one thing I couldn't help but think about was, I think about, like, you know, the imagery of this thing when it started, you know, the kind of the satanic cross they used, the sort of Nazi inspired cross that they used, kind of the images that they had, the colorful clothing, you know, the Satan's Cavern or whatever the coffee shop was called, like all of this, even the propaganda magazine. And you can actually find the propaganda magazine out on, you can look it up on Google and you can see the magazine, and it's, you know, heavily satanic magazine. And you look at all this imagery, and I can't help but wonder if it was fake and it was punk rock, you know, because, like, if you think about that kind of counterculture, you know, these bands, especially bands that play music like that, sinister music, they may not be necessarily living that lifestyle. Right. And if shit came down the pike, they might be the first ones to run from it and be like, hey, man, this is just an act I'm putting on. So you have this satanic church, and I'm making air quotes, and you know, Mick Jagger's interested in it, but then, you know, some bad stuff happens, you know, and you get associated with Charles Manson, and you're like, oh, we better soften our image up, because we're just, you know, we're just messing around here. It's just imagery, like, we don't mean any of this, you know. And I can't help but wonder, when you turn into a dog sanctuary at the end, was it ever real to begin with? Like, I can't help but think, at the end of this, was that imagery just there to be different, you know, to be different than everything else? Does this make any sense? Do you even understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, it does make sense. I think I had kind of a similar thought. So that, you know, they just had a lack of cohesion, I think, in the idea of what they really wanted this organization or cult to be. And so it just kept shifting and changing and went from one extreme to the complete opposite end, it looks like, on the surface. But like I said earlier, you know, underneath, it still had that feel of being this just kind of religious sect, still pretty grounded in Christianity. you know, as we know it today. And so I also wonder if that was just something that was used on the surface level, just based on the time that it was formed. Like you said, the counterculture around it, maybe the types of people that were getting involved. And then, you know, eventually they wanted to kind of go back to what those original ideas were and get back to that. And then ended up seemingly moving completely away from it. I mean, it sounds like there's no connection to any kind of religious aspect of this organization with the animal sanctuary now. Is that correct?
Yeah, so far.
So, you know, they've completely scrubbed it at this point.
Yeah.
But
they've changed directions multiple times. It might still come back. Who knows?
Yeah. So I maybe a lack of organization, although it seems like they were still pretty successful, even as it shifted and some of the, you know, bigger players changed.
We don't really know much about the financial structure of this, if this was a wealthy cult or not, but they did change names several times. And that's usually a tell. It's not that you just decide, oh, I don't like that name anymore. You change it because you're in legal trouble, or you're in tax trouble, or you want to kind of shift maybe the way your business is run or the type of business it is. So we do know that the name was changed multiple times, and that's usually for a reason, you know?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
So it's one thing if like a couple splits up and then, oh, it's like, well, we can't call it the process anymore because I did it with my husband. So now I'm going to call it the foundation of whatever. And then you still change the name two or three times. Makes you wonder what is going on there. Like what's happening behind the scenes we don't know about. And maybe the goal was to get rich. Maybe that was the beginning of McLean thinking, hey, I'm going to turn this into a moneymaker. We'll get rid of the Satan stuff. We'll make it Christian. We'll evangelize, you know, we'll get paid. So,
right.
But again, we don't know, you know, and all these cults we talk about in research, no one's coming forward to talk about the inner workings. No one's showing up saying, hey, I was at the meetings. This is what went down, you know?
That's a good point.
It's
well, I mean, you know, nonprofits and religions or churches, right, mm-hmm. are kind of in a similar tax situation. And so that could have been an easy move. To go from one to the next.
We always talk about this, and that is, you know, you from Nexium, for example, we hear from four or five people. Thousands of people came through and took those programs. That's undisputed. But we've only ever heard from like four or five people that talked about it. And with this, hundreds of members in each chapter, but no one's coming forward. It's hard to find anyone that's willing to be interviewed from this. In fact, the only interview I came across was from one of the kids that was at one of the communes that talked about his life growing up there. And he's an adult now in his own life. And he talked about all the problems that were happening in the commune. That's the only interview I've ever seen given. These people just seemingly vanish. And it's like this with so many cults. There were other members of the Manson family. We talked about that in the early episodes. Aside from, you know, five people that we covered that were the main members and Charles, there were still dozens more that hung out with them on the Spawn Ranch. Where are all those people? No one's talking about it. No one's been getting a book deal. No one's wanting to tell their story. No one's wanting to say, hey, Charlie wasn't so bad. These people just embarrassed about being part of it. You would think someone would have something to offer up one way or another. But no one comes forward. It's weird.
Yeah, that's true. That is a little bit odd. I mean, there's so many possibilities for why that might be, but it would be very, very intriguing to talk to somebody who was in, especially one of these cults that's maybe not as well known, but still has some ties to potentially Charles Manson, you know, Son of Sam, and some really bad guys that we all know about. And see what their thoughts would be on that, and their what their thoughts would be on whether this was genuinely a satanic cult that just eventually liked to save dogs, or yeah, you know, or what
which is better than sacrificing them, which is what the satanic churches usually do.
That is much better.
I think I'm going to go on a 2-year span of just research, and I'm going to take a meeting at every cult that I can. And then that way we don't have this problem in the future, Katie. When these cults all go belly up and kill a bunch of people or whatever it is that happens, I'll be able to say, hey, I was there. I went to that meeting on April 17th of 2025. I know what it was like there. And I can tell everybody. I can be the one guy who went to every cult.
It would be, I mean, yeah, that would be so just a unique experience to be a fly on the wall in even just a few different cults in our general area, I think would be amazing.
Go ahead and slot me in for like 900 hours of therapy when I'm done with that 2 years of
maybe during.
I'm going to need you to start specializing in deprogramming to get all the junk out of my mind.
Yeah. But especially when you start calling yourself the Omega.
Imperious leader.
Yes. The Imperious leader.
A group of luminaries. Yeah. Anyways. But hey, if anyone's out there that did take in a meeting at the Process Church or any other cult for that matter, and you want to talk to us, feel free to find us out there on Facebook at Cult Following or on Instagram at Join the Cult Following, or send us an email at jointhecultfollowing@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. And until next time, Katie, this is always fun.
Until next time, keep following.
That's right, for sure.
And we look forward to talking to you again very soon.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Father Daniel DePlantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest podcast. Have you ever wondered what the church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest podcast.
The Religious Hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.